Welcome to the Music Ed Matters podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Williams-Birch, and this podcast, it exists for you. Whether you're a music lover, an educator, a choir member, each week we bring guests to the show to help explore what matters in music. I'm so glad that you're here. Welcome to the show. Welcome to another installment of the True Change Alliance sponsored DARE series. Today, you'll hear from Dr. Tammy E. Tammy, Dr. E, is a strings professor. She teaches education classes and string technique classes at Chapman out in Orange, California. And this conversation will leave you with so many tangible tips and ideas as you seek to create the best classroom space for your students. I need you to come into this episode with a couple things on your mind. One, forgive me for the construction and dog barking behind my home. Sorry. But two, come ready to think about how you can be the best possible version of yourself for every student in your room. And then three, be ready for positivity. Because throughout this entire episode, Dr. E weaves moments to remember that you can look at everything through a positive lens. And that's my favorite part of this conversation. Dr. E uses a visual of widening the lens. We've all heard the conversation of making more spots at the table, putting in more leaves. But this widening of the lens is beautiful. And I can't wait for you to hear this conversation with Dr. Tammy E, brought to you by our friends at True Change Alliance. Today on the Music Ed Matters podcast, special TCA bonus DARE series, we're welcoming Dr. E. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
I'm so glad you're here. Dr. E is on the opposite end of the world from me. You are in California, in Orange County area.
Yes. Yes. Right next door to Disneyland.
Which is amazing. You were saying some of your students work there and go to school with you at Chapman. That's amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been really nice to be next door to Disneyland. A lot of our students participate in the ensembles, performing groups at Disneyland. So it's really nice.
That's a beautiful collaboration there too. And yeah. I love this. You're the first ever not choral musician that I have interviewed.
Oh, that's exciting.
I am so very excited. So for the listeners, who is Dr. Tammy E and what is your instrument?
Well, my name is Dr. Tammy E. I am an assistant professor of music education at Chapman University. My primary instrument is the violin. I'm also an international conductor, so I performed in many places besides the United States. That's basically it. My research focus is on diversity, equity, inclusion, and access. And I run my classes in a very democratic way with my college music education majors so that they learn how to teach diversity, how to teach for social justice. At the same time, develop a critical conscious mind.
I love, these are some beautiful words that I'm really looking forward to unpacking with you. What classes do you teach at Chapman? What all do you teach?
So currently I teach all the undergraduate classes right now. We are a small institution. I'm one of two. So I teach this year, I've been teaching Introduction to Music Education, String Methods, Instrumental Practicum Literature and Pedagogy, and Elementary Practicum and Mariachi Ensemble.
Mariachi Ensemble, that sounds like so much fun. How many are in that one?
So far we have about 12 students. The ensemble started this year. I won a pedagogical grant from my institution to start the ensemble. Orange County our school is primarily about 58% white student population, but we do also have a rising Hispanic population, especially being in Southern California. And so I saw the need for a mariachi ensemble, considering the fact that most of the K-12 schools in the surrounding communities already had mariachi programs. So I won this grant, and then I started the first collegiate mariachi ensemble in Orange County.
I love that you took what you saw in your community from the K-12 schools and found a way to fit it into your university. That's beautiful. All right, I'm dying to unpack some of these things. So what does it mean to have a democratic classroom?
Well, you know, with democracy in education, you know, there's many different viewpoints and people have, you know, different philosophies and theories behind it. But I can share with you some of the practices that I use in my classroom. So with the ensemble, when I conduct my orchestras, I alternate seats. I don't have students, you know, I don't have a hierarchy in the orchestra program where all students are full participants and they are the ones who decide how the music is supposed to be performed, what music we're supposed to perform, as well as how we should be seated in the orchestra. And for my college students, I have students participate in the overall curriculum in the class. So at the very beginning of the semester, I have students dissect the syllabus. And what they do is they decide to take ownership of the classroom. They decide on the curricular, they decide on the curriculum as well as, you know, how they should be graded, when these assignments should be taught throughout the entire semester so that they can take a little bit more ownership and agency in the classroom, as well as, you know, furthering their engagement.
So when you have them unpack the syllabus, what does that look like? Do you pose a question? Do you give them the syllabus first and tell them, come ready to take it apart? How do you set that up?
Yeah, I think a lot of our students come from very traditional way of teacher-centered instruction. That's been their experience. So it has to be brought up carefully because a lot of the students are, some will be resistant to it because they like and they're comfortable with just the traditional way of learning where the teacher just tells them what to do and when things are due. And others, you know, they think, wow, this is a great opportunity because we've never had this chance. This is our chance to take ownership of our education. So since most of my students are music education majors, I challenge them to think not just for the future where they're going to learn how to create these syllabus for their future classrooms, but in a way where the students, you know, could really guide their learning throughout the semester and guide, I'll take ownership of their own instruction. So how to unpack it, I do give them questions at the very beginning, right? So I give them questions and also opportunities for them to build a relationship with me. I make sure that we go through this community building as a community of practice, building trust that I think they had to learn really to separate themselves in a way that I'm not the teacher. I'm also a participant in this whole journey. And they had to trust that process and see it from me in order for them to start their own process of like, okay, so my professor is not a professor. She's a professor, right? She gives me the grade, but she's not really the professor. She's not leading the class. She has all this knowledge and all these experiences that she can help us. And there are things that, you know, we don't know. There's learning gaps. Like all of us come from diverse experiences in K through 12 education. Like you have students who come from affluent areas. You have students who come from low SES populations. And they're being meshed into one of the classes, for example, like my introduction to music ed. And for them to trust the whole process of a democratic classroom, they have to go through community building activities. And on top of that, I ask them these questions, right, about each other and how to have a conversation with each other. And then they build trust and then they eventually start, you know, going through the syllabus and saying, hey, I think I noticed from this student, they didn't have this experience. So maybe this is something that we can include in the syllabus. And I'll be like, okay, that's great. You know, and I'm also a participant in that democracy where I'm also saying, hey, or giving them some suggestions, but I'm not saying that this is the only thing that we should do. So it's kind of empowering for the students because, you know, the students are eventually going to be music teachers, right? So they have to learn how to do that with their future students.
I love that you are giving them power and showing them how to transfer it to their future skills. If I hear you correctly, and sorry for the dog barking behind my house, if I hear you correctly, one way we could use this maybe in a K-12 situation would be posing, here's the song or the goal song. How can we get about that and opening questions to make sure we address both the kids that have been in your ensemble for X number of years and the kids that are just starting and that type of thing? Would that be the same type of transferable skills when we talk about democratic classrooms?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the students do need a lot of guidance to really undo a lot of those hierarchy that's built in, where this teacher is separate from the student. And then the student, is able to create their own strategies because based upon the learning that they didn't get, right? And they're like seeing from others too what they didn't get, but want to get as well. So it provides them access and information to each other. And then I'm able to shape the class. And the teacher, if a teacher wanted to do this in K-12 setting, they can do it slowly first, not, like the way that I do with college students, because college students, that whole culture and the environment is about empowering our students, right? And using the student-centered approach, especially in our institution, which values that type of education a lot. But when it comes to K-12 education, it goes through a whole process. So you have to begin with building trust with the students. And then second, doing small assignments at a time. So if this class was traditionally run, very teacher-centered, in some ways, sometimes student-centered, you might want to do it with one assignment, one performance piece, like where students make a decision together, on what performance we should, what pieces we should perform for the concert, or what pieces should be performed in, this month, or how rehearsals could, be in the spaces. So the other, this example I just did with Kazmik, where I talked about culturally responsive teaching at Kazmik this year, and I shared how teachers could facilitate ways for students to, have a culturally responsive class. And the way that we can do that with one strategy is by implementing warm-up activities where students create their own measure. Each student will create their own measure for a full warm-up, and the teacher will put them all together. So if the teacher is like, hey, I want my students to really learn intonation, and I want them to know the D major scale really well, then the students will have an assignment. Each of them will have an assignment where they will have to compose a measure, and then the teacher will put the measures all together, and that will be the daily warm-up. And then what you can do, and as an extension of that, is that use that warm-up to give it to another class, have them try it out, and then vice versa. So it's kind of interesting because you're trying to create this entire culture, not just in your classroom, but throughout the entire string orchestra program, right? So all students are learning democratically and also listening to each other's works, their own creativity, whatever suggestions they have for the musical development.
I love that you're taking that student-centric approach to the whole new level by focusing it on community, trust, creativity, and collaboration. That is beautiful and so tangible. Thank you for sharing that idea. I'm totally going to try that in rehearsal this week. Just I'll let you know how it goes. So the next level, talking about teaching to transfer and building community, what does it mean? Can you define critical conscious music educators for us? And then what does that mean? How do we learn to become a critically conscious music educator?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of literature out there right now that talks a lot about critical conscious theory. I mean, we know that Paulo Freire really paved the way in the field of education so that we can develop critical consciousness as teachers, so that we are being aware of what kind of decisions that we are making in the classroom. And we have also, Gloria Ladson-Billings, who've also paved the way for culturally responsive pedagogy. And then you have, bell hooks, you have a lot of Black feminist scholars who write about critical consciousness. And so the nice thing is with critical consciousness, every single person who wrote about critical consciousness, or most people who've written about critical consciousness, are informed by people of color. And when they're sharing, you know, the motivation behind critical pedagogy is really because, you know, we're trying to open this lens, like, into the world of people of color and those who are marginalized and those who are oppressed. And there's kind of this structure, though, when it comes to critical pedagogy. So before applying those actual skills into the classroom, the teacher has to go through a transformative process. And so when the teacher goes through a transformative process, then they're able to apply strategies into the classroom that is either culturally relevant, culturally competent, that doesn't reoccur or reinforce the trauma, the racial trauma, especially in the United States. So the critical consciousness is, you know, I've heard this one really great example from a podcast, and they said that if you look into a classroom, you can, when you look into your classroom, look at your classroom in two thirds. And when you look at them, you have one type of group who's able to make the leap, right? And then you have this other group who's able to just assimilate into the classroom really easily. And then you have this other group of students who's unable to make the leap. And you're just wondering why is this happening? And I think the focus has always been on the musical outcomes of, like, okay, wow, we have students that perform really well. We're going to use those students towards our advantage, without even examining those students who the third are struggling and not able to make that leap. And usually those kids are the ones who are the most oppressed and marginalized, and who also struggle in their own social home environments, and they can't get ahead. No matter how many times they try, it doesn't matter. No matter how much access and resources we provide them, they'll never get ahead. So when we make the decisions in our classroom, so this is just an example, right? So when we make our decisions or curricular decisions or pedagogical decisions in the classroom, we have to be consciously aware of those third students, right? Those third students who aren't able to make that leap. Instead, the way that we approach those specific students, we're looking at them as if these students have particular problems. And the thing is, what critical consciousness as well as culturally relevant pedagogy is not looking at the problem. It's more looking at the good, the success of these students and teaching them. And so that's why critical consciousness theory is so important, because we have to really undo some of those systemic racism that we also have endured ourselves. So instead of thinking that this is the way it's supposed to be, we have to think, okay, well, everybody is different. Every student is different. Every student can succeed. And then looking at more of their successes rather than their failures could really help us start with critical consciousness and then eventually start, you know, designing pedagogical practices that are empowering for our students.
I love hearing how empowered we can make the students through this process of just a simple brain shift. Back in a couple episodes ago for the TCA bonus series, two of the co-founders, Ajori and Justin, talked about the power of praise and how so often we just expect people to do something a certain way. And so we stop praising them because it's an expected behavior. But instead, what you're saying, the starting point for someone who's looking to have a more critically conscious or a more culturally appropriate classroom is to really start celebrating the successes and the positives of every unique individual that you are looking at in your classroom. That is such a cool way to do it. And to empower those students is a mind shift to positivity.
Absolutely. But I think with the critical consciousness, though, like, it needs to start before that, right? We need to understand how education works and how education society has always been this banking model where the system of education has marginalized and oppressed so many groups. And without that understanding, of course, we can see it, right? When in our K-12 classrooms, we're like, okay, well, we know that this student will need these resources. We know that these students, but when we're trying to provide them access, so we're like, okay, this student comes from, is on free and reduced lunch. So we assume that they probably come from a low SES population, right? So we provide them access, like, okay, we have to give those students instruments because they can't, you know, afford the instruments like the more affluent counterparts. But the problem is, yeah, we're doing it. We're giving them the instrument. But when it comes to the curriculum itself, it's not really teaching them to empower them. It's teaching them to assimilate, right? So we already have those kids who can assimilate well into the classroom. But when we're looking at students who are marginalized and we're trying to assimilate them into our pedagogy, assimilate into our orchestra classrooms, we're trying to change who they are. We're trying to change, like, you know, their background and where they come from. And it's not just about music, right? It's also about the way they learn. And the way that they learn from home environments is significantly different than the way they already learn in school. So students are unable to make that shift where they're like, okay, well, this is how my parents have taught me. And then I come to school and this is what my teachers have taught me. And this is how I'm supposed to learn. This is how I'm supposed to do things. So they're not being taught to be empowered. Instead, they're being taught to change, to be something other than themselves, which is really harmful. So when we make decisions as far as curricular decisions in the classroom, these types of practices are becoming harmful. But without that knowledge of critical consciousness, of how to develop that critical consciousness, we can't even see the injustices that we do in the classroom.
I love that you clarified that for us. Question, kind of twofold, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking about these students that are going to be put back in the classroom once this virtual hybrid learning situation that's all different across the country. And I feel that there's going to be that same transition of learning happening. What are some tips for not forcing change into our students? What are some ways or some strategies that we could implement that would celebrate the different learning styles and help them remain true to their roots?
Well, I think the first thing that, I'm going to talk about racially, right? And that's kind of like what we're going through this racial reckoning right now. Although we've been fighting for racial justice for many years, right? For many centuries, you know, a lot of teachers are still asking the same question, like, why is this still happening, right? Well, we're part of the problem, okay? We're part of the problem, and also music is also the part of the problem. So what I suggest for many teachers when they get back into the classroom after they have done all their literature and readings, right? So everyone's probably waking up right now. We can get easily distracted when we get back into the classroom to go back to the pedagogy that worked well for us. And as teachers, we're not supposed to be stuck in a traditional way. We have to constantly modify and adapt based upon our student demographics. And even though we're comfortable with some, you know, pedagogy choices that we make, it's not servicing all students, right? So like I said earlier, but when teachers go back into the classroom, what would be really helpful is to what I said in CASMIC conference last week about my lecture on culturally responsive pedagogy is to examine your library. The first thing is go to your library, because that's the first thing that we can think about, right? Critical consciousness is a whole process. It's not just like, you know, something that we can just figure out one day. No, like it's a whole process. Even when we are trying to develop the pedagogy, we are practicing this critical consciousness. So go examine the classroom, go examine the music library. And if you don't have equally diverse repertoire, then start buying some music, right? Or start destroying some music, because some music has been written as a way of cultural appropriation, right? So start doing the research, start, you know, examining like, oh, you know, it has this, I don't know, this arranger or this composer, have they culturally appropriated this? Is this something that my students would even want to play or perform? So look at the library. Second, look at your wall spaces. Do they represent all your students? And if you're like really not sure how to, okay, well, I don't want to assume my students like are, you know, this demographic and they are going to assume that they like this or whatever, ask the students. start implementing strategies to include student voices. So you could also ask this, I mean, the students are pretty open. They'll tell you everything, right? But maybe we're asking only the certain students who do well in our class. Maybe we've been, you know, looking at those students. And so ask all students, try to create strategies where students' voices are all being heard and collect that. Like we're kind of like these researchers trying to figure out what are the best practices for my classroom. And like for one school district, it might be different from the next school district, right? So we have to constantly adapt and shift our pedagogy to meet the needs of the students, our own demographics. So checking the wall spaces, visually, we can see things, visually see color, right? Make sure there's a representation of a diversity in all spaces. So our music literature, walls, posters, how we set up our classroom, like in an orchestra. I mean, I don't know much about choir, but I know that orchestra has like this hierarchy, right? You have the violins who all sit in the front, right? And then you have, you know, cellos here and the basses all in the back. Even that setup alone is oppressing some students, right? So even that is the way that even K through 12 string orchestra literature has been written for is because of that reason, right? The seating. So I would suggest like implementing alternative seating where maybe you'll have one day students, the bass students sit in the front or mix it up, a bass student next to a violin student. Start finding strategies to mix things up and get messy, right? Get messy, but watch and see like what happens, what develops. And look at the positive of that rather than, oh, that didn't work. Look at more of the positive and, you know, make the students, allow students to make the decision, like the choice of how seating should be arranged in the classroom. So visually first, I would recommend teachers visually look around their spaces and start implementing some strategies where you can include student voices as part of the decision-making in the classroom, not just the seating or the walls, but as far as like, how do we communicate? What kinds of words we can use? I mean, I've had high school students who kept calling a sharp a hashtag. And you know what? I said, fine, I'll just call it a hashtag then, you know? Of course, I shared with them what it really means. But then in a way, it's like creating this new language with the students and I, where I'm like, oh no, that's an F hashtag. And I would keep saying that over and over again with them. And then that's, you know, they start remembering what that is all the time.
It connects to where they are. That's a big aspect of what we are getting in those rubrics. When you do student teaching observations, we have a rubric for the state of South Carolina. And one of those is ability to connect with the students and make meaningful connections to their life and their situations. And that's one of the hardest things for these first year teachers, student teachers that are still stuck in their bubbles. You said four things that I just can't, I have to reiterate because they were beautiful. I love how you have strewn positivity into all of this. Things aren't always going to go like you're planning, but finding the positive, that is such a huge part of the whole story as we all seek to have a more critically conscious and culturally conscious classroom. Two, you are drawing attention to the research that we have to do as educators to break the barriers. And it is us that will continue to make the problem if we don't stop, reevaluate, and do the work. And then three, don't make assumptions. Holy smokes, I love that you said that. That was so good. And then four, you're giving us even more ideas for democracy in the classroom. Asking students, but not just the ones that come to you early, but all the students. This is so much tangible goodness. Thank you for sharing this.
Absolutely.
When and how do we now implement social justice practices in our spaces? I think you've given us some good ideas to get started, but what is your personal definition of social justice and what are some practices that you would encourage?
Are you asking for the orchestra space or are you asking about?
You can talk about the orchestra space and we can make transfers to the choral space. Talk about whatever you're most comfortable. But I love asking people who do research in social justice, what their definition and their view on those two words together mean. And mm-hmm. then just some thoughts that we can all think about and transfer and connect to our own classrooms.
Yeah, absolutely. So to me, social justice is providing equal access and opportunities to all participants, all people. So that includes myself, that includes my students, that all students' voices are heard, including myself. Nobody is more powerful than others. And the social justice practices that I first, including those strategies that I've already implemented in my classroom, what I've done was in my own research, especially in my dissertation, was debunk the whole theory about like hierarchy models as a motivation to practice. And I think for many years, the form of competition has been embedded in the school system, right? Ever since its beginning. And so when I worked with a very diverse group of students, half of them were Haitian, half of them were, mixture of white, Asian, and Latinx students. When I worked with those students, I would always see how my Haitian students would sit in the back of the orchestra. And of course, being someone like me who really cares a lot about social justice, not just social justice in the classroom, but social justice in my own life as a woman of color, after experiencing a lot of racial injustice, and someone who has grown up in poverty situations, I was able to really see and identify that intersectionality where my Haitian students, not only were they Black students, they were also poor students who parents were refugees. And third, language too, that their parents didn't speak English, they were speaking French. And it's really interesting because when I first was able to associate and see like, oh my goodness, like my Black students are sitting in the back of the orchestra. What the heck is that? And it's not them. And this is when I came to a new school, right? And so when they did that, it was shocking to me because it's noticeable, and the students chose to sit in the back, right? So I learned the history of the ensemble and heard that there was like chair challenges and seating auditions, and or even students racing to orchestra class to sit in the front of the orchestra. And I'm like, where the heck did this come from? Where students think that, you know, of course I know the history of the hierarchy in the orchestra, I've seen it before, but you know, where the heck in a public school were these kids? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, music is for all students. But to see the hierarchy model in the public school system, instead of like the pre-colleges that I worked at, or conducted with professional ensembles, it was shocking to see that. And so because the school was so diverse, I had to really undo some of that trauma that came with the whole competition of seating hierarchy. And it was kind of mind-blowing. And so what I did was create 4 different seating approaches into the orchestra classroom where that was voiced by the students, where they thought, they included their voice in the decision making. So the first one is circle seating. So what I did was have students sit in the circle where they have to play, no hierarchy, right? Obviously, they have to sit with someone different every single day. And they were sitting in the circle, either it is facing one direction or one facing the other or whichever way. And then the second day class, I did scrambled seating where students were, you know, mixed around in the classroom. It didn't matter which instrument that they played. And the third seating was, obviously the rotational seating where we would rotate into our own sections. And then the fourth was the most powerful one that I felt that really challenged me as a teacher as well. And I used randomization. And I randomized the seating for every single concert and competition. And so students never knew where they were going to sit. And they were either, I used a randomization bucket where I got their names and drew the names. And during a concert, right before the performance, I put their name on the chair like that. And the students were like, it was fun and scary though for the students and for me too, because I took that to competition. And I used a randomization app to have students seated instead of using that 20 minutes of rehearsal time. But the students were so used to practicing it in the classroom that they were like, well, this is how it's going to be. So, you know, it doesn't matter where you sit. And so the students who took private lessons, at first they took issue to the whole seating practice, of course, and so did their parents. But after a while, I started to hear some of those students, and as I conducted my research, how undoing that hierarchy model has really helped them with their anxiety. Like, they didn't feel like there was this pressure from their parents that they had to sit first chair and they had to do well and so on. And in the end, the students still won won first place at competitions. It didn't matter. I mean, some of the adjudicators thought it was crazy. They were like, you should be practicing 20 minutes before we're giving you 20 minutes to rehearse before your competition. And I'm like, it doesn't matter to me. Really, it doesn't matter. I care more about, this equitable practice. And I was so determined to make sure that the students also saw the equity. So they were part, when the seating, every time that the seating was announced, they would see me and my process of doing it. They would see the equity and be like, oh, okay, so this person's sitting there, she pulled the name out of the bucket, she did this, whatever. So that I'm being very transparent about how I'm doing this. So that's kind of like one of the things that I've done as a strategy in my orchestra.
I love that you called it a seating approach instead of a seating chart, or that in and of itself tears down some barriers. And you're addressing something that we hear from our singers all the time, their anxiety levels. And you're addressing it almost around the back door, and you're removing it as a secondary approach. First, you're bringing everyone to the table, but then you're removing some of the anxiety. I think this reminds me of a couple things in choir. There's kind of like the front row phenomenon where you either really, really want to be on the front row or you really, really don't want to be on the front row. I personally never wanted to be on the front row, but I'm really short, so I was always on the front row. And it was a joy when I got moved to a different row. But there's kind of a unspoken, especially when you walk into honor choir experiences, where the students want to be on the front row to be closer to you. And I love how this removes that barrier in a way. By having the rotating rows, maybe you have them rotate every 30 minutes in rehearsal, or the mixing up of sections. All of the ideas you've given us are completely applicable to the choral setting, especially the seat randomizer. That sounds incredible. But as you were talking about people racing, I'm just envisioning like second grade class running down the hallway to get to music so they can sit in that one spot they want to sit in. I'm just envisioning. So this, what a great first step towards social justice in our spaces. You've given us so many tangible ideas today. I always let the guest share one thing that really matters that you want the listener to walk away with. What would be your one thing you want them to never forget from this?
I guess as we are all trying to do the good work, I know that many teachers are trying to be more woke about what's going on in society right now. What I want to say is we need to stop racial trauma. And when I say racial trauma is, as teachers, we can be comfortable with a certain practice that is inequitable, it's socially unjust. And what's happening is that racial, for someone like a person of color, that the racism occurs in all areas of their life already. So our classroom, especially music, which is supposed to be teaching our students about creativity and openness and to accept other cultures and so on, that's our opportunity to change how society could look in 10 years. And so what's been happening is that some students, or most of our students of color, are being marginalized, not just in the school system through tracking or whatever it is, they're being marginalized even in their home environments, where it throughout society, where they're walking to the mall, or where they're kind of, you know, just living life either through social media. And the thing is, while we are in this pandemic right now, those students, our students, our students of color have been watching the reoccurrence of racism, and they're being traumatized and re-traumatized. So when we go back into the classroom, I hope that teachers, you know, really work on being more critically conscious of what they are implementing, because they're the ones, us as teachers are the ones who are reoccurring that trauma. And then there's no healing ever. So it goes, and sometimes teachers associate like such behaviors, right? Like the way a student is becoming oppositional or this, as if this student is as a negative behavior. Instead, we have to think about things racially in all areas, how the student is just got re-traumatized by something. And so that's why I keep saying, like, we have to look more at the successes rather than the failures, because since we focus so much on the negative behaviors, and we address those negative behaviors in our classroom, address it as if it's a problem, we're not healing our students. And when our students need us the most, especially now, since they've been watching so much images of themselves dying, and seeing how society is reacting and thinking that's okay. So that's okay. That type of violence is so normalized within their community. So it's important for us. So the takeaway would be for teachers is to continue doing the good work, because our intentions are always in the good place. But focus more on the impact that we are making on our students. And as adults, I think we can do that on our own without anybody telling us how to do it.
We can do it. Thank you for giving us so many valuable pieces of wisdom, of beautiful definitions. Thank you for sharing your research areas with us and your time. It's been a joy to get to know you.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you and with your audience.
You can have a positive impact. You are having a positive impact. You, my friend, matter. Thank you so much for listening to this special bonus episode brought to you by our friends at True Change Alliance. I know that you know music matters, and I can't wait to see you next time on the Music Guide Matters podcast.